From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump is set to announce Wednesday he's reversing decades of U.S. policy and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. But he's also expected to delay moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Mr. Trump made his decision known to several Mideast leaders in phone calls Tuesday.
He did speak with a number of leaders this morning, and he's going to continue to have conversations with relevant stakeholders, but ultimately he'll make what he feels is the best decision for the United States.
Among those leaders he spoke with, Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu, Palestinian leader Abbas, Jordan's King Abdullah, Egypt's President el-Sisi, and Saudi King Salman. Nabil Abu Redena is a spokesman for Mr. Abbas.
If the American embassy is going to be moved to Jerusalem, this is against the international law, and this will be unacceptable from our side.
Mr. Abbas warned of the dangerous consequences such a decision will have on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Palestinians view East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. U.S. Secretary Rex Tillerson in Europe received much the same message from EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, who said the two-state solution must be preserved.
We believe that any action that would undermine these efforts must absolutely be avoided.
Saudi King Salman also warned it would inflame Muslim feelings worldwide. Reports indicate the International Organization for Migration and the African Union hope to return up to 15,000 migrants voluntarily to their home countries from camps in Libya to ease overcrowding. As many as 700,000, mostly African migrants, are believed in dozens of camps across the country. The decision came after video footage was made public showing migrants being sold into slavery. This is VOA News. The International Olympic Committee, acting on a report on allegations of state-sponsored doping Tuesday, announced it's banning Russia from competing in the upcoming Winter Games in South Korea. Thomas Bach is the IOC president.
The report clearly lays out an unprecedented attack on the integrity of the Olympic Games and sports. The report includes in particular the manipulation of the anti-doping laboratory at the Olympic Winter Games Sochi 2014.
Bach said individual Russians could compete as Olympic athletes from Russia. The IOC also suspended Russian Olympic Committee President Alexander Zhukov as an IOC member. Zhukov, who said he had apologized to the IOC, called the ruling controversial, but said was glad clean Russian athletes would be able to compete and their team would be called Russian. Deputy Prime Minister Vitaly Mutko was also barred from future participation in Olympic Games. The U.S. Tuesday urged the warring factions in Yemen to end the violence and restart political talks to end the three-year-old conflict. Following the death of the country's former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauert described the humanitarian crisis in Yemen as desperate.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen remains dire. It really does. And one of the things that we ask for when we speak with our partners in the region, when we speak with the Saudis, is, for example, to allow more humanitarian access in. We know that the people need that so desperately.
Saleh was killed by Houthi rebels after ending his alliance with the Shia rebel group. His son has vowed to lead a campaign against the Houthis. Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri Tuesday rescinded his resignation of last month after his coalition government reaffirmed a long-standing policy of non-interference in regional conflict. Hariri's unexpected resignation, announced in Saudi Arabia November 4, ignited a political crisis in Lebanon, where the Iran-backed Hezbollah movement wields considerable influence. Hezbollah has been active on the side of Damascus in Syria's civil war. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has pledged strong U.S. support for the European Union as he met with officials in Brussels.
The partnership between America and the European Union, I think, as everyone knows, is longstanding. It is one that's based upon shared values, shared objectives for security and prosperity on both sides of the Atlantic, and we remain committed to that.
Tillerson met European Union and NATO alliance officials. He'll also travel to Vienna and Paris. Spain's Supreme Court has withdrawn an international arrest warrant for Catalonia's former regional president, Carles Puigdemont, now in self-imposed exile following October's controversial declaration of independence. Tuesday, campaigning officially began for new elections in Catalonia, December 21. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December the 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Malawi President Joyce Banda says women leadership in Africa cannot be stopped.
What we are saying as women leaders is that we have started and we cannot be discouraged, and it is our responsibility, those of us who have been in leadership, to get together and to rise and to support fellow women.
The Malawi Congress Party has ended its boycott of parliament over electoral reforms. South Sudan says it wants to change the mandate of the UN mission in South Sudan. The military wing of Cameroon's secessionist movement says it is prepared to fight back. And Sierra Leone's main opposition party criticizes government security reform as military reform.
We are calling on them to maintain a professional policing that will enhance credible, free, fair and transparent elections. Anything falling short of that will not be accepted by the SLPP and will be resisted.
Lahai Lawrence Lima is the publicity secretary of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, and some government agencies and NGOs team up to fight corruption in Uganda. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Malawi President Joyce Banda says she and Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, along with other African women leaders, have opened the door for more African female leaders so wide that it can no longer be shut. She says now is the time for she and other vanguard African women leaders to support more women leadership. Banda took office in 2012 as Malawi's first female president following the death of President Bingu wa Mutharika. She lost her re-election to current President Peter Mutharika in 2014 and has since been living in self-imposed exile. Her tenure has been plagued by a $250 million corruption scandal known as Cashgate. Former President Banda, who is currently in Washington, D.C., along with Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, joins us now on Daybreak Africa. Madam President, first of all, let me say welcome to Daybreak Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you. What brings you to Washington, D.C.?
We were meeting at the African Union today. The African Union ambassador here, who is female, Dr. Arikana Chombori Kwao, decided to invite and celebrate women's leadership, and so invited myself and President Ellen Sirleaf to share with our colleagues our experiences. In my particular case, they wanted me to discuss child marriage, economic empowerment, and women's leadership, and the stubborn link those three areas have.
Madam President, your election and the election of Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who you are with right now, created some expectation for African women in leadership. Do you think that expectation has been fulfilled, or do you think there's some damper that maybe Africans may not be as much interested in electing more women to power?
No, I truly believe that the world will look at the whole situation of women leaders across the globe. So I want you to start from Australia, look at what happened to Julia Gillard, go to Thailand, see what happened to the Prime Minister there, go to Philippines, go to Myanmar, and go to Zimbabwe, go to Argentina, go to Brazil, go to Chile, and end up in America. So I think that issue is a long issue. We cannot discuss in a five-minute interview. But I think all in all, what we are saying as women leaders is that we have started and we cannot be discouraged. And it is our responsibility, those of us who have been in leadership, to get together and to rise and to support fellow women. But I would like to take this opportunity to thank African men, because we work together. Our understanding of feminism is not to antagonize our men or to be confrontational, but to engage them and to work together. And that is why, as African women, we are proud that we have done better than most continents. In other continents, they are still trying to get a woman into state house. In Africa, we have had four. We have had Catherine Panza in Central African Republic, apart from the two of us, and Mauritius now has a female president. So instead of dwelling on negatives, we need to focus on what has been possible. It was the first experience for Africa. But I believe that it is our duty also to support women, get them into leadership, bearing in mind what women across the world are confronted with when they try to participate in leadership. And so therefore, we are not discouraged. We believe that we've tried our best. In my particular case, I want to take this opportunity to thank our men who have opened up space at the policy formulating table for women to participate.
That's former Malawi President Joyce Banda speaking with us here in Washington. The opposition Malawi Congress Party on Tuesday ended its boycott of parliament after the government agreed to table an electoral reform bill. The opposition and some civil society groups have been asking the government of President Peter Mutharika to enact an electoral reform bill that would include a provision requiring a 50-plus-1 vote for any candidate to be elected president. Lazarus Chakwera is president of the Malawi Congress Party and minority leader in parliament.
Our concern is that we want the electoral reforms bills to be brought to Parliament at this meeting. And we have put in a request that they extend the time so that the bills are brought in. And the people's concern is that if we don't discuss these bills now, we will not be able to have these reforms enacted for the 2019 elections, and that is the concern. And so we have put in a request, and they were consulting today. They will tell us tomorrow, and we will continue with the business committee after that decision is made, and then we will see what course of action to take.
I was reading that one contentious issue of the bill is the amendment of Section 80 of the Constitution, as well as Section 96, to provide for a change of the electoral system from a simple majority to a majority. Can you explain why this is contentious for you?
We believe that this is the way to go in order that we may consolidate our democracy, because the system we've been using, which is first past the post, sometimes we'll have a president elected with a minority of the vote cast, and we want the 50-plus-1 to at least ensure that whoever is elected, the majority of voters have voted for that person.
So you want it from a simple majority to a majority of more than 50% before a person can be declared president?
Exactly.
Let's say there are 3 or 4 candidates in the race. Does Malawi have a system where the 2 leading candidates can go to a runoff?
That is the proposal. At this stage, we don't have that.
So if there are 3, 4 candidates in the race and the person that leads after the vote will be declared winner?
That's correct.
Now, the bill has been tabled. That means, did the speaker agree now that they will include your concerns?
No, the bill has not been tabled. We are demanding that they table these bills so they are discussed. The speaker has pretty much agreed that the government side consult and then bring back a report after they talk with the president and other stakeholders.
Do you find that maybe the government is not in favor of the suggestion you are making?
Well, we want to find out if their commitment to these reforms is genuine or not, because that's what they've been saying all along, and we want them to prove their commitment to these reforms by actually tabling the bills rather than shifting the goalposts, as it were.
It's very nice to talk with you, sir, and thank you very much again.
I'm extremely delighted. Thank you for the opportunity.
Lazarus Chakwera is the president of the Malawi Congress Party and the minority leader in parliament. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Today's Wednesday, December 6th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. The South Sudan government says it wants to change the mandate of the UN mission in South Sudan, known as OMIS. Currently, the OMIS operates under a Chapter 7 mandate, which authorizes peacekeepers to use military force to defend civilians under threat. But South Sudan's cabinet affairs minister says the mandate should be modified so that peacekeepers only focus on development, including building the capacity of government institutions like police and security. Wake Simon Wudu has more from Juba.
The Kiir administration says it wants Chapter 7 of the UNMISS mandate revised before the UN Security Council votes on renewing the peacekeeping mandate later this month. A UN team from UN headquarters in New York is in South Sudan to assess the situation on the ground. The team met with the South Sudan First Vice President Taban Dengai and other government officials in Juba. Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomuro emerged from the meeting to tell a journalist the government believes the Chapter 7 mandate should be eliminated because, in his words, South Sudan is already peaceful and stable.
Peace is already returning back to the country, and we feel that the resolution that is under Chapter 7 for protection of civilians should now revert back to Chapter 6, which encourages development.
The UN Security Council granted UNMISS a Chapter 7 mandate in August 2016 after fighting flared up in Juba between government soldiers and forces protecting former First Vice President Riek Machar. Consultant Kevin Kennedy, who is leading the UN team that has been visiting South Sudan for the past week, says his team met with several government ministers and other officials to assess whether the current UNMISS mandate is realistic.
Is the mandate being accomplished? If not, why not? What are the gaps? What can be done to close those gaps and so forth?
Kennedy says his team is also trying to understand the context under which the UN peacekeepers are operating in across the country.
Our concerns are they able to accomplish the currently assigned mandate? If not, why not? Should that mandate be adjusted or modified? That's our primary interest.
2 weeks ago, the special representative of the UN Secretary General, David Sierra, announced the UN team's visit. He said the team would assess South Sudan's security situation and consult with a number of government officials and representatives from 8 agencies. Sierra says the team will also spend 2 days in Addis Ababa to meet with the other South Sudanese groups, including the opposition.
The strategic review team will then report back to the UN Secretary General, who in turn reports to the Security Council. And its findings will help inform the decision of the Security Council on the renewal of the UNMISS mandate.
South Sudan government officials have stated repeatedly that they want the UNMISS mandate changed. Information Minister Michael Makuei told the reporters at a news conference in Juba back in September there is no need for UNMISS peacekeepers to operate in South Sudan and said the UNMISS mandate should only be renewed with Juba's consent.
Juba is at peace, but when somebody comes and he sees this UN moving, Talata, Arba, Thatcher moving just like that with their guns, what message will that person take away with him? And this is why we are talking of revisiting the mandate.
For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP, is criticizing the government's security reform, describing it as a military reform. Lahai Lawrence Lima, publicity secretary of the SLPP, says the reform is of serious concern to the SLPP, particularly as Sierra Leone prepares to hold presidential elections in 2018. He says the ruling All People's Congress Party has a record of using the military and the police to rig elections.
In this democratic politics where we find ourselves today, the security sector is very key to our democracy. And so at a critical period like this, when we are moving towards elections and we are getting the major changes in the security sector, it is of serious concern to us as an opposition, particularly so when this APC government has a history of using the security sector, particularly the military and the police, to rig elections. But before we come to the ministerial changes, let's go back to the security sector itself, where the Inspector General of Police and the military boss were changed. Now, for the Inspector General of Police, because of his utterances and disposition, he had shown himself clearly as a partisan character instead of a professional senior police officer.
I thought maybe it's in the interest of the opposition, the fact now that Inspector General Francis Munu has been moved from the police force. And I understand he's going to be, what, an ambassador to neighboring Liberia?
That was the expectation. But contrary to the expectation, we have the presidential spokesman, Mr. Abdullahi Berete, saying that a reliever of Mr. Munu is not based on the call of the opposition, and therefore the new police boss will continue to do the work Munu has been doing. And Munu has not been doing a professional policing. So if the presidential spokesperson is saying that, it is telling us that the fear we had in Munu is still present, irrespective of whatever call. So it is a very critical moment, and we are closely monitoring the situation. But what we will do in this electioneering period is that we will maintain the vigilance we had always maintained. And we have aired out our views that what happened in the last elections, where they ask us that when we vote, we go back to our homes. We will not do it this time around. When we vote, we will not disrupt the voting centers, but we'll stay around to monitor the counting of our ballots, and we'll ensure that we maintain the vigilance necessary to ensure that this election actually is credible and is conducted in a manner best possible.
One of the reasons I think the supporters of the ruling APC are saying that these changes are necessary because with the 2018 elections coming, they have heard the opposition SLPP saying that if the SLPP does not win the election this time around, there will be violence.
We are talking of a political party that has history of using the security sector to rig elections. The issue about violence, it is not about the opposition talking about violence, but we are saying that we will resist any election that is not credible, that is not free and fair and free from intimidation. We have said that even giving us a security sector that can also even intimidate the mindset of the people is also, again, leading towards undermining the credibility of the elections. You have most of these heads of security sectors carrying party cards, and the ONS boss is no exception to what I'm saying. And also the conduct and demeanor of the sacked former Inspector General of Police has also been a party card carrier of the APC. But our position is very clear that this time round, we will not accept any rigged elections and will resist any elections that is rigged. And that is more the reason why we are calling on them to maintain a professional policing that will enhance credible, free, fair, and transparent elections. Anything falling short of that will not be accepted by the SLPP and will be resisted.
Lahai Lawrence Lima is the publicity secretary of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. The Cameroonian government has vowed to crack down even harder on secessionists in the English-speaking areas of the country, referred to as Southern Cameroon. The Abazonia Governing Council, a militarized branch of the movement hoping to break off from Cameroon, says it is prepared to fight back. And even state radio said President Paul Biya has declared war on the militants. Chief of Staff for the Abazonia Governing Council, Roland Tenu Fomenyam, spoke to Ricky Stryak about why the group is fighting.
Position has not changed because we have been crying and talking to the powers that be to make sure our issue is resolved amicably, but it's like they pay people's death, yes. And we have said we are going to defend ourselves. We have to pick up arms. Self-defense is democratic and it is lawful. So we have a right to protect ourselves. We can't let our people to be killed.
What are you defending yourselves from in terms of human rights violations?
It is beyond human rights violation, because when we look at it as if it is a human rights violation, then we are saying, or the world is saying, we are part of Cameroon. We are not part of Cameroon. We are a people different from the people of Cameroon. Cameroon got our independence on the 1st of January 1960. We got ours on the 1st of October 1961, almost a year after. But given the manipulation that took place when Britain left our country, Cameroon took over, because at the time we had no military. So Cameroon just came in with their military and took over us. And given the kind of people we are friendly people. We like to live with neighbors. We thought, oh, it's good, we can live with Cameroon. But over the years, 5 decades and counting, it has proven contrary, that Cameroon is not the kind of people we thought they were. So it is time for us to be on our own.
What actions did the Cameroonian government take that led your group to say you don't want to be part of Cameroon anymore?
Given after, from 1961, the argument was we have to be as a federated state where we manage our affairs, they manage our affairs, and then we converge at the federal government to see how we run the two states together. But that has not been the case. It has been a situation where they now impose on us what they think. It will be shocking for you to know that we built the airport they have in Douala, we built the seaport they have in Douala, through the company called the Produce Marketing Organization. That company was an Ambazonian vision run by Ambazonians, who unfortunately is of late. But when we came together with Cameroon, they came into that company, crumbled it, and today the company is no longer there. And that's what they have done to us. Every of our structures have been destroyed. You know, they have impoverished us, keep us at a very weak position, and we are saying that is going to continue. We want to fight for our rights.
Have you tried before to suggest a vote on the issue, like if the region could vote for secession?
Yeah, in 1996, a signature referendum was conducted. 99% of our people voted for us to be separated from Cameroon. But it is interesting to know that Cameroon is a country that does not respect the law.
That was Roland Tenu, former YAM, chief of staff for the Amazonian Governing Council of Southern Cameroon. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. Some government agencies and NGOs are teaming up in a fight against corruption in Uganda, but they say their fight faces a challenge from some top officials who they say gang up to divert public money. Irene Muyangonya is the head of Inspectorate of Government, a government agency that fights corruption, says sometimes officials connive with international contractors to swindle government money. From Kampala, Mugumi David Rakaringe reports.
The theme of this year's campaign against corruption is restoring integrity in civil service, regaining public trust in the anti-corruption fight. The theme emphasizes the need to cut down corruption by educating both citizens and civil servants about the effects of corruption as well as how to prevent it. Irene Muyangonya says corruption hinders socioeconomic development.
In every district, there are various hospitals and health centers, but there are no known mechanisms for complaints going to the people who manage them to address the failures or lapses in the provision of services. And we believe that this failure to address the lapses is what results in impunity. And once you have impunity, then you will have corruption resulting from the impunity.
Muyangonya says corruption deepens income inequality by diverting money needed for social amenities like health care and education. She says it is the poor who are mainly affected because they cannot afford to pay bribes in order to access the needed services. She says during this year's campaign, officers from her department are having radio talk shows, town hall meetings, local known as barazas, posters and banners to sensitize the public about the dangers of corruption.
Rampant corruption obstructs development and hinders the attainment of both global and national development goals. For the case of Uganda, failure to attain a lower middle income status by 2020, which is the goal set out in the second National Development Fund, may be attributed to the levels of corruption in this country. Corruption further defies and undermines fundamental human rights, institutions, and the belief in the systems that have been created.
Julius Mwesije, who works with Public Procurement and Disposal of Public Assets Authority, one of the agencies mandated to reduce corruption, says the fight against corruption is a difficult one.
You see, corruption, all the corrupt people, they also, every time they change tactics, okay? That's why the first theme was fighting organized corruption, which was syndicated corruption. You find someone knows someone there, someone don't, someone knows there. Now, for this year, you see, we have decided to go to the public, okay? These spot checks we are doing on the way bridges, in the prisons. The biggest ally we want is you, the public.
In one of the recent corruption scandals, an estimated 24 billion Ugandan shillings meant for road construction was swindled. Muyangonya says such cases are unfortunately common. She says her office received over 3,000 corruption complaints in the year 2016-2017, of which 207 were prosecuted. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakalinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Botte, wishing you a good Wednesday.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.